Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Well, there wasn't much of a choice on our opening story tonight. It is the coronavirus outbreak, and I'm going to just talk a little bit about what Yogi Berra said about it being deja vu all over again back in 2003. I think this is important context for the discussion. China was very, very heavily criticized for not fessing up to the fact that there was a sudden acute respiratory distress syndrome. It was started in China. It had spread all over Asia before the Chinese actually admitted there was a problem. And this time, they did much better on that. They did, once they identified the outbreak of coronavirus in a city called Wuhan, they began communicating back in December of 2019, late December, and saying, you know, we got a problem here. Looks like a new virus. It was rapidly identified to be related to SARS, the sudden acute respiratory syndrome, also a coronavirus, and MERS, the Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, which you may not have heard of, but which is spread by camels. So don't let a camel, I'm not going to let a camel sneeze on me when I go to Morocco this spring. But anyway, getting back to Wuhan, they traced the outbreak to a seafood and animal market where, and indeed, there's a kind of tradition about viruses spreading from Asia and spreading from animals in Asia to people in Asia and then spreading all over the world. And this is what happens with influenza. It's an interesting phenomenon, and I don't think anyone has ever really elucidated how come this happens. Lots of hypotheses, but no real data, but it's one of those interesting things that are hard to explain. But this is, in fact, the direction of the vector. So this was reported on December 31st to World Health Organization. Since then, there have been a lot of infections. We're going to talk about the numbers in a moment, but I want to emphasize how fast this is moving. I'm looking at a CDC report that was distributed to doctors on January 17th, 2020. This morning, I checked in with the French newspapers and then the New York Times, got a lot of information. And then this afternoon, I checked back again, and lo and behold, a new story. We're going to start with that. The Chinese have shut down the city of Wuhan. This is a city of more than 11 million people. That's about the size of Los Angeles, guys. That's a very, very big city. This virus has already spread halfway around the world as of now, or rather as of 3 p.m. today. No planes and trains are leaving Wuhan. No buses or subways or ferries are moving within it. The Chinese government has basically told people to go to ground and stay there. And everyone who is a native of Wuhan is required by law to wear a respiratory mask. So far, we're up to 540 confirmed cases, mostly in Taiwan, Japan, Thailand, South Korea, and of course, China. This morning, they announced the first case in the United States. This was a guy who had traveled to Wuhan, hadn't visited any animal markets, hadn't come across anybody who was sick. But when he started getting sick and got the memo on the Wuhan connection, he went and reported to the police, and or rather to the health authorities, who then called up the CDC, sent his blood to the CDC, and it was confirmed that he has this particular coronavirus. So at least, thank God, we've got rapid detection on this thing. So we know it's flying around the planet as we speak, and I'll have some suggestions for you in just a moment. This Wuhan lockdown, that's the hashtag on Twitter that is trending with 1.6 million views, reminds me of the Albert Camus book, The Plague, which is about a lockdown in Algeria, if I believe, of bubonic plague, which takes place in the mid-20th century. And, of course, in my mind, it brought up thoughts of my what some of the things that have happened during the Ebola epidemic, which is basically people being told to stay home in Monrovia in Liberia the last time in 2014. They actually shut down a whole neighborhood and put police around it, had a cordon, and there were riots for people who wanted to get out because they felt quite rightly, that as long as they were trapped in that area, they were more likely to be exposed to the infection, and they wanted to go somewhere else before they got sick. In 2003, when we had the SARS outbreak, Singapore put people, anyone who they thought might have SARS, put them on house arrest and monitored them with webcams and put electronic bracelets on them to make sure they stayed put. This is a very big deal. More than 30,000 people fly out of Wuhan on the average day. People are taking this very, very seriously. And with the amount of modern travel, they need to. Let's hope that this disease is not as contagious as SARS, which was very, very contagious. Maybe it's less contagious. It's hard to tell right now, but it's clearly jumping from humans to humans. So it's not just a problem for people with animals anymore. They've got a guy in Mexico that they think has it. He's a researcher in a university biotech lab who visited Wuhan, says he wasn't anywhere near an animal market. At least that's as of 3 p.m. on the New York Times. Obviously, a lot of this information is tentative and will get revised. But here's what we know so far, and here's my advice for you. First of all, if you're going to be getting on an airplane or visiting an airport in the next 2 weeks, I want to point out, I'll tell you that you should be wearing a mask. So go buy a mask. Go buy some regular surgical masks. That seems to be good enough to prevent the spread. If you want to get fancy, you can buy an N. That's an N as in Nancy 95 mask. And those are what they use in everything but the level 5 biosafety lab. So this is like, short of a respirator, the best mask you can get. Yeah, they're more uncomfortable, but if you are traveling, I would definitely wear one. I think that the plans, and I will outline them in a moment, for containing this are going to be drastically inadequate. For one thing, this can look like the common cold, and here's the big one. For another, it has an incubation period of about 2 weeks. So we don't know if people are shedding virus before they start running a fever, but just like SARS, all of the surveillance and case trapping is going to come from people with a temperature. So as of this morning in the United States, there are 5 major airports that have been designated as the places that everyone who's coming from Wuhan is going to get routed to. There won't be that many people coming from Wuhan anymore, but unfortunately, it's all over many areas in China. So hopefully most of the people from China are going to come through LAX, San Francisco, JFK. They also have O'Hare and I think Atlanta, but I'm not 100% certain about that last one. They're going to basically put temperature sensors on the cameras as you walk down the, as you walk off the airplane and you walk over to baggage claim, you're going to be monitored. And if you've got a fever, you'll be pulled off and checked. And I don't know how they're going to be checking people, and I don't know what their plan is for the people they collect, but I'm confident that they have one. That up to 2 week incubation period has got me really worried, because that allows people to feel fine and in good conscience go where they're going and get sick. And then meanwhile, how many people have they exposed? If it's very contagious, we could be looking at a major issue. Symptoms: high fever, difficulty breathing, shortness of breath, and characteristic lung lesions on x-ray. So, and plus, we've got a rapid detection. So in a 24-hour turnaround, you can either take the person out of isolation or keep them in it. Treatment? Well, there's the rub. Don't got one. Supportive therapy only. And it's clear, at least the Chinese scientists are saying, that it spreads from people to people. So we need more information than we've got. But in the short run, if you are going to be getting on an airplane, Dr. Don says, You know, good hand hygiene. Yeah, that's important to avoid a cold. This one seems to be respiratory. I think you need a mask. Let's see. It was Atlanta. I just found the piece of paper. Ironically, this is a contribution from Charlie, my intrepid producer. It is the year of the rat. That's a notorious disease vector. Oh, I want to point out something else. Really bad luck for China. The New Moon Festival, which is like everybody takes, this is the New Year's, the lunar year, is coming up. Everybody takes a week off from work. They go visit their families. People travel everywhere in China. It's like the epidemiological nightmare that suddenly we've got this virus. It's already cropped up in a bunch of major cities, just a few cases, and now everybody's going to travel. It's a major revenue source for many Chinese businesses. As you may know, the Chinese like to save their money. This is one of the occasions when they'll actually spend it. And so all of the vendors, it'd be like if someone called off Christmas for retail. And that is pretty much what we're looking at. We're looking at they're going to cancel Christmas in China because of this virus. And let's hope that's enough. These are modern times. There's a lot of travel. Things spread very quickly. And particularly with something like this, we know it can mutate. Hopefully, it will mutate in the direction of being less virulent, which is the rule. But still, this is a very big deal. Great way to celebrate the year of the rat, I guess. Oh, bit of medical trivia that relates to this. You remember I said wear a mask? Well, surgical masks actually predate the understanding of infectious disease. In fact, before anybody knew there were germs, there were surgical masks. Go ahead and Google or search on your favorite web search, plague doctor. These guys crop up in the 13th century in Europe during the bubonic plague. And they're basically doctors who wore a very peculiar piece of headgear, a mask with a long beak on the end of it. It sort of looks very much like a bird, and goggles, glass lenses. So it really does look like a costume. They stuffed the beak with cotton and fiber and essential oils. And because it was, and they breathed through it, this was supposed to keep them from getting plague, which was thought to be spread by evil miasmas or mists. And it actually did help prevent them from getting pneumonic plague, and also the smell of the herbs and the stuff that they put on their garments repelled the fleas that were actually the vectors for bubonic plague. So ironically, it was a very effective, it was good, it worked for all the wrong reasons, but it is a little bit of medical trivia. The first surgical masks were used around 1349. Where they even really had surgeries. All right, our first email comes from Sandra in Chapel Hill, and she writes, Belsomra, dear Dr. Dawn, will you discuss the sleep aid Belsomra, the benefits and, of course, side effects? Thank you for this and your continued public service. Well, Belsomra is the trade name for a chemical called Suvorexant, S-U-V. Orexant. And the orex part relates to orexin. Orexin is a recently discovered brain hormone that is a part of the wake-up persistence circuitry. In other words, once you wake up, have you noticed how you stay awake, sometimes even when you don't want to? Well, that's because of orexin being released and stimulating orexin A and orexin B, binding to receptors called OX1R and OX2R. Belsomra, or suvorexant, works by preventing this binding. So, in other words, it's not that you're falling asleep, or it's not that it's stimulating melatonin or hitting the GABA receptors or any of the other mechanisms for sleep. It's actually turning down what's called the reticular activating system. So you're just turning down the wake up rather than turning on the sleep. It is a very effective agent. It's got a couple of problems. chief problem among it is it's got a fairly long half-life, about 12 hours. So when you turn off wake up, you may have a little problem turning wake up back on. And this particular seems to be the case for women, about 8% of whom suffer unacceptable levels of drowsiness the day after taking it. Another minor but potentially significant problem as the drug gets more wide, once it goes generic and it is widely used, and we may see that there are more problems with this. It's actually looks pretty clean right now, but the problem is no one's using it. The reason no one's using it is it's awfully expensive, and all of the insurance companies are denying it unless you've taken literally every other single sleeping medication out there and failed them or had an adverse response. As a concierge doctor in my practice, I do like above and beyond medical care. My patients pay me a monthly fee instead of my having to be chasing the insurance companies to get reimbursed for work I've already done. So guess what? I have more time to take care of my folks, and I try to take the best possible care of them. And that means filling out these prior authorizations over and over again. So I've actually gotten patients on this drug, and it worked quite well. It was an older man. The nice thing about these are that you don't get the respiratory depression. You're not going to worsen sleep apnea. You're not going to affect the pathways in the brain that are associated with dementia, because we do know that all of the over-the-counter sleeping pills, with the exception of melatonin, are associated with a increased lifetime risk of dementia. And that's even when you control for utilization. So that may not be a great drug to be taking to sleep. That was problem number one, the long half-life. Problem number two is that it's metabolized primarily by cytochrome 3A4. Well, lots of things are metabolized by cytochrome 3A4, but if you're going to take Belsomra, I would definitely remember, and hope that most doctors remember, to tell you not to drink grapefruit juice or consume a lot of grapefruit, because there is, in fact, a strong inhibition of 3A4 by grapefruit and many other drugs as well. The list of potential interactions is therefore quite long, and anyone taking this would need to check their interactions carefully. But all of those things being said, if you're not on a lot of other medications and you tolerate and you can sleep in, it's a really excellent agent. And I think particularly for the very elderly, I'm much more comfortable using this than I am using the hypnotics, the Ambiens of the world, and all of the other agents in that hypnotic category, because of issues of increased risk of falls, increased risk of fractures, and increased risks of dementia. Our next email is from JD in San Francisco. And JD writes, JD has a lot of questions, so first of all, thank you for answering the questions I had a few months ago. I really appreciate it. I'm the woman in her 40s who was recently diagnosed with asthma after a 9-month-long diagnostic odyssey. And before I go any further, I was just talking to a patient about this. And the number of people I see in my practice who have seen a whole bunch of other people and had a whole bunch of different diagnoses is probably skewed by the fact that, you know, I'm the radio doctor and I now have a reputation and word of mouth for doing the difficult diagnoses or finding stuff to help people who haven't found help elsewhere, which, you know, I'm very proud of that. So I guess I'm bragging a little bit. But I also want to say that the current structure of how we deliver healthcare is aggravating this substantially. The amount of time that physicians, nurse practitioners, and physicians' assistants have to see primary care patients, the amount of protocols that they're required to follow, the rigidity of the electronic medical record, and the time consumption that where you're just doing data entry effectively and not sitting there and thinking. When I write my notes or when I go back and dictate them, that's when I do a lot of my thinking. That's when I pull the picture together. But if I've already put a note in the computer, and I will add also, if you're following up as a consultant, those computer notes are pretty useless. You end up having to you end up having to start over because they're so boilerplate. They're like one of those fill in the blanks kind of stories where you just, you know, you just pick the noun and the verb and, you know, you've got a funny story. I used to play a game where you pick a noun, pick a verb, pick another noun, and then when you plug them into the story, you would get some hilarious results, which maybe it's not so hilarious when we're talking about healthcare. All right, enough editorializing. Some more questions from JD. Can you talk about dead space in lungs? That's a scary sounding thing, isn't it? Dead space. So let's talk about dead space. Effectively, in medicine, there's two kinds of dead space. There's the natural one, which is to say any part of your airway that is not absorbing oxygen is dead space. So that would be the inside of your mouth, the inside of your nose, your trachea, and your major bronchioles. It's not till you get down into the flesh of the lungs that you get to the alveoli. And so any parts of the lungs with air sacs are normally, for the most part, not dead space. Now, when you empty your lungs, you don't empty them completely, right? They don't collapse. Instead, they shrink. And so the amount of air that's left in the alveoli is dead space. It's dead air because it's already had all of its oxygen absorbed and it's full of CO2. And when you breathe in, you fill all of the alveoli, and the residual dead space air, which was just there to keep the alveoli from collapsing totally, because when that happens, the lung has a hard time opening back up again. All that did was a space holder. Now the whole thing opens up fully, and you've mixed that CO2 and you pulled all that oxygen out, and then you exhale and you wait for the next inhalation. Now, the alveoli are connected to teeny tiny pipes, which are connected to slightly larger pipe, which are connected to slightly larger pipes. And our lungs are supported by, you never see this on pictures of the lungs, but they're supported by the flesh itself, by these little, scaffolding almost of wires. And these connective tissue structures keep the airways open. They keep them from collapsing. If the tube collapses, it doesn't matter if the alveoli over there has air that it wants to get rid of. You can huff and puff and push and compress the chest all you want, but if the tube's already collapsed, you aren't going to get any air past it. And so obstructive pulmonary disease of all kinds, and that includes asthma and emphysema, are various versions of a situation where these tubes collapse prematurely. And that premature collapse traps air in the alveoli and does not allow for mixing, so you don't get emptied. So when the next time you breathe in, part of the lung that would normally have been deflated and be able to open up and accept new air is full. So it's like pouring water into a bucket that's full. It just can't enter. And so that's called dead space ventilation. So you're breathing, but the air is just bouncing off the dead air that's already in the alveoli. And then when you try to breathe out, the airways collapse again and the dead air stays in the alveoli. It never gets squeezed out of there. In emphysema, it's primarily a disease where the structural scaffolding has gotten damaged. And so the pipes collapse because they don't have the normal support. In asthma, the problem is that the pipes, which are not just passive pipes, they're dynamic muscular structures. So think they are tubular muscles. And if they go into spasm, they get smaller. And that way you don't get to blow all your air out because there's not enough time to get the air out through the narrowed tubes before you have to take a new breath. And so with an asthma attack, with that airway spasm, you develop progressively more and more dead space ventilation until you can reach a point of crisis where we have to intubate you and use a higher pressure than your body is capable of producing through your diaphragm and your muscles and just push the air in to the alveoli, and that holds the airways open and you're able to start ventilating. Also, you can put more oxygen in because you're using a higher pressure. And that allows the remaining alveoli to work. And you can start to use bronchodilators and other agents to get those tubes to open up and alleviate the crisis. Before we had these drugs, before we had ventilators, death from asthma was not a rare event. In fact, my great-grandmother died in her 40s purely from bad asthma. So this was probably around 1915, 1920. When she passed. So that's just something to keep in mind. This is a relatively recent thing that we've been able to help. Well, I think we've covered dead space ventilation fairly thoroughly. JD's next question. I found something called Pure Research Products formulated with Lactobacillus rhamnosus lysates in capsules. I've been taking this. And then I found Culturelle Daily Probiotic, which contains only Lactobacillus rhamnosus. Does the probiotic have to contain only L-rhamnosus, or should I just contain some? The Lactobacillus rhamnosus, folks, is the one that has the most scientific juice for treating asthma and eczema and other allergic conditions. And the dose that's been, again, science, placebo trials, love that stuff. 10 billion organisms a day is a treatment dose. Now, the lysate's interesting. What lysate means is that they've taken the bacteria, killed it, and digested it enzymatically. And I, honest to God, don't know, have any idea, and I'm not sure that there's research, but there may be, showing that that works as well as just giving the actual living bacteria. The problem with the lysate is you're going to chop things up, and if you chop up the signal that's actually doing the job on the allergy, and we think it's a chemical signal coming off of the cell wall of the bacteria. That seems to be what's going on here with a lot of the communication between the immune system and the microbiome. So I don't know if the lysate's going to work. I do know that the lactobacillus has solid data. I wasn't able to find any research on the lysate specifically in the short period of time I had today to prepare for the program. So from the standpoint of the science, when they did the science, they only used L-rhamnosus. From the standpoint of what I would recommend, I would say using a mixed probiotic and taking a prebiotic, something that's a good probiotic chow, like inulin, which you can buy in powdered form, or other fructooligosaccharides. You'll sometimes see that abbreviated FOS. Yes, it stands for fructooligosaccharides, people. Just keep that straight. Anyway, taking some FOS and some inulin, probably a good idea. Small amounts, you know, a teaspoon would be plenty, just to make sure that you've got the right microbiome and that you reverse anything and that you get that reversal. Let's move on to steroids. Why are inhaled steroids so bad over time? I'd like to get off these, as I've read the side effects and they don't seem great, but my pulmonologist says not to worry. The inhaled steroids are just absorbed locally and are not an issue. It's all a dynamic grayscale here, JD. So how much, if you need steroids to stay out of a serious asthma attack where you will be given oral and or IV steroids, your bones and your skin and your risk for diabetes are happier with the inhaled steroids. If you take nothing but inhaled steroids, there is still an incremental increase in your risk for the bad things, which is to say diabetes and osteoporosis. However, the risk is substantially less. And like I said, the main thing is to breathe and be out of asthma, not needing rescue inhalers. What I try to do with a lot of my patients is get them checking a daily peak flow so they know what their peak flow should be when they are well controlled, and that becomes their personal best. And then we try to subtract the drugs. We try to use natural agents. We try to use things like Singulair, which is monolucast, which can be very helpful in allergic asthma, and limit the use of steroids. If you get on all those other agents, you may be able to taper off your steroids and just take them when you have a cold. And that, I think, is a very appropriate and safe way to manage asthma, if you can get it down to that point. They are absorbed. It's just that the volume of absorption is lower, is basically the point here. The allergist tested me for a cat allergy. I do not test allergic to cats, but I definitely can't be around them. When I go into someone's house who has cats, I start having symptoms. I also frequently go to vivariums that contain large amounts of mice. I never had a problem before. Now I have a large adverse reaction. Same thing when I go to a pet store, which may have different kind of animals. But no problem when I hold my chiropractor's poodle, a so-called hypoallergenic dog. Well, I just think it's because dogs are much, much more calming than cats. But that's I will admit to my prejudice. Cat people, I actually grew up with cats and have asthma. So you got to understand there's some negative juju there. So let's talk about allergy testing, the not testing positive for cats. I don't know what kind of test you had, JD. The blood test is not very accurate. The skin test is pretty good. It's about 90% accurate. So if you were around cats recently and you had a flare and you went in and within a week got a skin test and it was negative, then I'd say it's interesting, but obviously you're reacting to something, so you have to avoid cats. And by the way, there is a pill that's available now commercially that you can give to your cat that causes its spit not to contain the protein that most people are allergic to. You just may be allergic to something else that's found in mammals. It turns out people can be allergic to lots of mammalian proteins. Maybe you've got something that's also shared by mice that we don't know how to test for. Clearly, this was a change after you got very sick. It took antibiotics. We talked about this before on a previous show. Trashed your microbiome. Probably had allergic tendencies to start with. And this whole thing just locked down. And now you're in what we call in chaos mathematics, a bad attractor. And we're going to try to eliminate all of the things that are sustaining that attractor. And that means being really avoidant of things you react to until you get on top of your allergic reaction. At this point, you're highly reactive. Your lungs react to cold weather, to pollution, to fragrance. You have extreme pulmonary irritability. And yeah, the steroids are going to help shut that down. The Montelukast will help shut that down. The lactobacillus will help shut it down. And the quercetin I told you to take will help shut it down. I also highly recommend you take up meditation or some form of stress reduction. I sometimes it's a mistake to read between the lines on an email, but you seem to me to be a very thorough and thoughtful person, but I wonder if you're also under additional stress. If you are, please eliminate stressful and toxic people in your life and try to get, if you have a toxic job, by all means, try to switch out of it. If there are family issues, do your best to resolve them or avoid them. And or put distance between yourself in any way that you can emotionally, because you need to get your immune system out of red alert mode. And I think that's a piece of what's going on here. You're on red alert, and that is causing you to be highly allergic. And you've just, you got to, you know, calm everything down. Get a few more questions. I'm going to go really quickly through them. Biomat is something you asked about. Never heard of it. Looked it up, and it turns out to be a plasma selling company. So I think you would need to send me the link. I'll be happy to follow the link and look at it. I don't know what a biomat is. Expanding on my thoughts of gabapentin is kind of a very too general a question to cover. If you'd like to rephrase that, I'd be happy to answer it. But I think I'd be just flailing right now as that just isn't sufficiently distinct. Talking about polyunsaturated oils' effect on health. If these are, I guess the simplest way to talk about oils is pretty clearly the safest oil to use is olive oil, except if you're cooking with it, because olive oil deteriorates when you heat it up to high temperatures. So no bueno. You got to find a secondary oil for that. A oil that is derived from walnuts or avocados is a very good cooking oil. It has a coconut oil as well. But oils are high calorie, saturated oils. You have to be careful about making sure they don't smoke. And if you smoke them, don't eat them. Don't smoke oil. I think the vaping thing has told us all of that. But actually, when you smoke an oil, you develop some things that are actually toxic in it. Most of the trans fats are made from polyunsaturated oils. I have a story that we'll go to about coconut oil. But the issue about oils is that certain oils have different enough properties that you really have to look specifically. And the best oils, as I'm saying, according to my current reading of the literature, olive oil mixed with walnut or avocado oil or coconut oil to get the heat temperature up. When you mix oils, they tolerate higher heat. You aren't eliminating this extremely healthy monounsaturated olive oil, which is probably one of the best ones out there. Peanut oil and butter, you also asked about specifically. Whatever you can get your kids to eat is good. Okay. Peanuts, fine. I would try to get them into almond butter. Peanuts have some toxins in them sometimes, depending on how long they've been stored. And of course, a lot of peanut butter has added sugar. Butter I'm really fond of for people. It is a saturated animal product, though, so it needs to be used in moderation. But if you're melting butter on your vegetables or using a small amount of butter on a slice of whole wheat low glycemic bread, that's okay. And I think especially with children, you got to pick your battles. So let's do sugar and high fructose corn syrup and plastic. Those would be the big ones I'd want to keep out of reach of your children. And I think you can compromise on the peanut oil. Okay, we're going to go to Sandra from Santa Cruz. Hello, Sandra. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dolan.
Hi.
Hi. So I wanted to ask you about how one determines when we always hear about coronary artery disease. How does somebody come to the conclusion that they have that? And along with that same question, very importantly, is I wanted to get your feelings about the calcium score test.
Okay.
That's being given now. Do you think that's a test that's really valuable in determining coronary disease?
Let me take the second one first.
Okay.
So I will just share some personal information. I tend to run a high cholesterol. I have a very high good cholesterol. So most of my cholesterol is the good stuff, but I have enough of the bad stuff, large particles, low inflammation. And so, you know, I don't believe that I need to be addressing this with a pill, particularly a statin. I really think statins need to be used for people who have the disease. So I thought, all right, I'll do the coronary calcium as a tiebreaker. And so I did my coronary calcium and it came out very good. So I'm happy with my current plan for cardiac health, which is exercise and a high plant-based diet. And I don't worry, and I use lots of olive oil. And apparently at least as far as coronary calcium goes, it's pretty good. Now, in general, plaque and atherosclerosis will calcify when it's old. And so when you have low coronary calcium, you probably don't have a long-standing built-up plaque burden. You could have some fresh plaque, because fresh plaque, which is actually the most dangerous kind, doesn't calcify. Once it's calcified, it's going to give you angina, but it's actually probably not going to break and clot, because first you get a crack, and then the platelets jump on the crack, and then they pile up, and they block the blood vessel, and off we go to the races with the heart attack. But it's the softer plaque, you know, if you think about it, it's like if I try to build a dam, like an earth dam, and the river's flowing across it, you know, as a child, I was always trying to get to make a pond, and, you know, the water would work its way through my dirt dam, and I'd spend hours happily trying to make a pond, and my parents were doing something else and quite happy about the matter. But that, if you think of that, visualize that earth dam getting eroded away by the flow of water, that's your new fresh plaque getting eroded until finally you expose some collagen and the platelets just jump on it. So it's not a perfect test. It tells us one piece of the picture. And if you're dealing with an older woman and her calcium score is low, then I feel very reassured about her long-term chances. And then I factor in other things like family history and what's her inflammatory level and is she diabetic and does she smoke and does she have hypertension and all the other risk factors. Now, your first question, how do you know if you have heart disease? Well, if you have to qualify it, you can't really know if you have coronary artery disease at all. You can know if you have enough blockage in the arteries to start interfering with function. And to find that out, you basically have to go to a stress test of some kind, either taking an injection that makes your heart beat fast, or if your legs and knees will take it, you're running up a hill while you're hooked up to a monitor, and looking at the electrical changes, which indicate poor blood flow. So if you have, let's say, a 10% or a 30% blockage, most of us can't exercise hard enough to reveal that. Now, they have invasive studies, and that's called an angiogram, and you've undoubtedly heard of those. So you you stick a thing in the blood vessel, and you go up into the heart, and you squirt dye around. That's super invasive and has its own set of complications. So we don't do that for screening. And the treadmill and the sometimes an echocardiogram at the same time, plus the EKG, is what we have for screening. So that's the scary part, is it's like, I don't see any icebergs on the surface of the water, but there could definitely be some icebergs floating around just below the radar, so to speak.
Well,
and,
can I say this?
Yeah, go.
Can I ask you this specifically? I just recently had a stress test that it came out. They didn't get specific, but it was normal, and they said that means I'm not having a heart attack now. They didn't really indicate that it was a sign of a healthy heart, but just that at that moment it was good. I had an EKG, and that was good, but my calcium score is almost 5,000, and I am an older woman. And I am wondering if I'm basically a vegetarian for the most part. I mean, the diet couldn't have caused this. And I'm wondering, the cardiologist wants me to go on steroids, and I don't really understand how that's going to help the calcium score. And I don't really understand how freaked out to be about this. I am pretty freaked out because it seems like, you know, I've got very bad... I've got very bad calcium buildup, whatever that means.
Well, okay. So I can completely understand what an emotional shock something like that is, especially since you've been, you know, you've been checking all the right boxes. What's your family history like? Do you have a lot of people with strokes or heart attacks?
My dad did die of a heart attack in his mid-50s, but he had a very different lifestyle, and I always kind of chalked it
It would have to be multiple relatives. So your dad, let's take your dad out of the story. Who else?
An uncle, but that's about it. My mom lived to 94. So.
Grandparents on both sides?
No heart attacks there.
Mm-hmm. And you are an older woman, so you have any siblings?
Yeah, no heart attacks there either.
Okay.
No siblings.
So it's not, you don't have a horrible family history. You do have a very interesting, that's an extremely high calcium score. There's something that's genetic or it's physiologic. And I would take a look at, parathyroid hormone and see if you maybe have elevated parathyroid hormone that could possibly be stealing calcium and your body is just stashing it in your blood vessels. I'd certainly immediately go on fairly high doses of vitamin K2, which might help with further calcium. But remember what I said about the old plaque being calcified and the new plaque being dangerous? And you don't, and you passed your passed your stress test, so you don't have angina. So the blood flow to your heart is good. So I think you've got what they used to call hardening of the arteries. And we've gotten so focused on cholesterol, we forgot about this thing called arteriosclerosis, not atherosclerosis, arteriosclerosis. Mm-hmm. And that's basically an X-ray of your chest would probably show calcium in your aorta. I'm guessing that might be that might be worth checking. But it seems to me that there's something physiologically different. I have, and I have to take the fifth here. I've never heard of the steroid thing. for high coronary calcium score. So I will search that and get back to you on it. But I'm just drawing a blank on that one. And the main thing is, you know, you're going to continue your healthy lifestyle. Would I put you on a statin? Probably not, unless it, because lowering your cholesterol is probably not going to shift this calcium. But I'm not sure this turns you into what we call, with behind people's backs, a vasculopath, which is to say someone who's just blood vessels are shot. So let me do some research and follow up on these super high calcium scores. Normally, you know, it's bad to have one in at 100 or 200 or 300, but 5,000, it's like that's outside of my frame of reference, and I just can't speak to it. But it may not be as bad as you think. So let's take some deep breaths and remain calm.
Okay.
And I will follow up on it. I promise.
Okay. So I will connect directly, you and me.
Well, you know how to, I know who you are, and you can connect with me directly. So you can catch up with me next week.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you, Dr. Dawn.
You're welcome. I thought I'd jump to talking about the biological clock. I have two stories related to that. The first, and let's just, you know, your circadian rhythm, right? That's your biological clock. You wake up at a certain time in the morning and you get drowsy at another time. That's related to orexin and melatonin and other things that we've been talking about over the course of this program. Well, it turns out that certain therapies work better at certain times of day. It's called chronotherapy, and it's been a big thing in chemotherapy for a while because in studies looking at effectiveness of chemo, it turns out that if you give the chemotherapy at different times of day, and I believe it's generally giving it in the evening, but I'm not 100% sure of that, you get better outcomes. The problem is our society isn't set up to do that. We don't have evening infusion centers. Maybe we need to, but there's a lot of inertia in the system. Coming to antihypertensive medications, of course, this is something that chronotherapy has also been attributed to. And there have been small studies suggesting that maybe people do better if they take their blood pressure medications at night, but they've been small studies and they haven't really been terribly influential. Concept is that there is a thing called the renin-angiotensin system. This will raise blood pressure. It makes hormones that tighten up those blood vessels, which, just like the airways, have circular muscles around them. And that's most active at night. And of course, we know that strokes tend to happen in the wee hours of the morning. Heart attacks tend to happen in the wee hours of the morning. There's all sorts of circadian risks associated here. A Spanish team took 19,000 primary care patients, all with hypertension, and randomized to take their medication either at bedtime or upon awakening. When they started, they all had roughly similar blood pressure levels, and they were matched for things like weight, comorbidities, laboratory tests like LDL. They were followed very, very closely with 48-hour ambulatory blood pressure measurements annually for 6 years. And the risks of all of the composite endpoints, and that's a composite of cardiovascular-related death, heart attack, needing a stent or a bypass, heart failure, and stroke, significant difference, half almost the frequency in the group that took their blood pressure drugs at night compared with the wake-up group. 6.5% morbidity in the nighttime group and 11.9% in the morning group. And there were no excess risk of falling or fainting in the bedtime group. So I think pretty definitively we can say that the time is ripe to start taking your blood pressure medicine at night. And possibly the exception would be the diuretics, which in my opinion are not a true blood pressure medicine anyway. So let's think about chronotherapy with blood pressure. If you're taking blood pressure medicines, you could go ahead and start taking them at night, or you could ask your doctor first and then start taking them at night, because I don't think your doctor will have an objection. Just got to remember to take them. Another biological clock story. This one just published. This was led at McGill University, and they looked at taking anti-inflammatories in post-orthopedic patients. So if you had knee, shoulder, or hip surgery, you might not want to take your anti-inflammatories at night. The study had people, looked at people recovering from surgery, gave them their anti-inflammatory drugs in the morning and in the afternoon, but not in the evenings. This finally explains the conundrum about do non-steroidal anti-inflammatories delay healing? And the answer is yes, they do. They slow down healing and bone repair after surgery if you take them during the resting phase of the circadian rhythm. And that's because they inhibit the osteoblasts. Those osteoblasts are your bone rebuilding cells, and they work the night shift. On the other hand, the osteoclasts, which are your cleanup crew, they work the day shift. And so taking your anti-inflammatories during the day helps destroy some bacteria, and it also helps allow for, it doesn't really interfere with things because the osteoclasts are not substantially inhibited, but the osteoblasts are. So taking your anti-inflammatories in the morning and just taking a big dose of Tylenol at night looks like the best strategy. Healing occurs at night. Sleeping is critical. I think for health, it's probably the most important thing. And just while we're wrapping up this hour and we're talking about sleep, a neurovascular process flushes toxins from the brain during sleep. So this was looking at beta amyloid and how it leaves the brain. A recent study, this was published in New England Journal of Medicine 2018, so about 18 months ago, documented the existence of the glymphatic system, small vessels, sort of like lymphatics, that exist in the brain. In this new research, researchers looked at sleeping humans using prolonged functional MRI. I don't know how they could sleep in an MRI machine, but they did it with EEGs. And they found that slow wave sleep leads to reductions in cerebral blood volume and increases in the interstitial fluid and increased flow through these ventricles and these small vessels. This basically shows that slow wave sleep is important for getting your brain cleaned up. Now, there are drugs that we know about that increase slow wave sleep. One of them is something called ritanserin, not available in the United States, not FDA approved. What is approved? Well, interestingly enough, gabapentin, pregabalin, mirtazapine, which you may know as the antidepressant Remeron, trazodone, also an antidepressant, but used a lot for sleep, my favorite sleep drug bar none, and clonazepine, which is Zyprexa. This is an atypical antipsychotic, not something I'm going to necessarily give to people to help them sleep, but I'm really going to look at trazodone and gabapentin much harder over the next few months as patients come to me looking for help with sleeping. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.